60 Minutes, coming up next.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL, the number 70.
Good communication is key to business, especially when you need to work with people who aren't in the same office. So how do millions of business professionals connect with remote clients and colleagues? By using Citrix GoToMeeting, the proven solution for meeting and collaborating online. And if you sign up for GoToMeeting before October 10th, you'll get another Citrix product of your choice free for 6 months. GoToMeeting lets you share the same screen so everyone stays on the same page wherever they are. And with built-in HD video conferencing, you just need a webcam to see each other face-to-face. GoToMeeting helps your team work smarter from any location and on any computer, tablet, or smartphone. So start working smarter today. Sign up for GoToMeeting today and get another Citrix tool free for 6 months. Visit GoToMeeting.com and get started. But don't wait. The special offer ends October 10th. So visit GoToMeeting.com and sign up to receive this special offer today.
Do you know the name of the director of the FBI? Maybe not. But after our story tonight, it'll be hard to forget James Comey.
Some people call individuals who are radicalized lone wolves. Is that the biggest threat we face?
Yeah, people use that term. It's not one I like because it conveys a sense of dignity I don't think they deserve. These homegrown violent extremists engage in jihad after emerging from their basement.
The name lone wolf offends you?
It does. I'd prefer lone rat.
We're in a situation where a cancer diagnosis is one of the leading causes of personal bankruptcy.
He's talking about the astronomical cost of the drugs that help keep cancer patients alive.
How do you think they're deciding the price?
It's corporate chutzpah.
We'll just raise the price, period.
Just a question of how brave they are and how little they want to end up in the New York Times or on 60 Minutes.
Tonight, the story of the doctor's revolt against the high price of cancer drugs.
We're almost there. We're almost there.
Meet Chaser. She may be the smartest dog in the world.
Chicken, chicken. Where's chicken? Yes, good girl, good girl.
Researchers say she has a vocabulary of more than 1,000 words and knows the difference between nouns and verbs. What is science learning from man's best friend?
That's good.
You'll be surprised.
When dogs and humans make eye contact, that actually releases what's known as the love hormone, oxytocin.
Thank you very much.
When dogs are looking at you, they're essentially hugging you with their eyes.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
I'm Bill Whitaker.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes.
Do you know the name of the director of the FBI? Probably not. James Comey has been America's top cop for just 1 year, and he hasn't done a major television interview until tonight. We had a lot to cover. We wanted to know whether a terrorist attack is imminent and how hackers are breaking into our computers. Along the way, we learned surprising things about Comey himself, like the time he was held hostage at gunpoint. We sat down with 53-year-old James Comey in his command center at FBI headquarters in Washington, where one of his urgent concerns is the whereabouts of Americans who've joined terrorist groups overseas.
How many Americans are fighting in Syria on the side of the terrorists?
In the area of a dozen or so.
Do you know who they are?
Yes.
Each and every one of them?
I think of that dozen or so, I do. I hesitate only because I don't know what I don't know.
With American passports, how do you keep them from coming home and attacking the homeland?
Ultimately, an American citizen, unless their passport's revoked, is entitled to come back. So someone who's fought with ISIL with an American passport wants to come back, we will track them very carefully.
ISIL is the acronym he uses for the Islamic extremist group occupying much of Syria and Iraq. The U.S. is bombing ISIL and an al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria called Khorasan.
Was Khorasan about to attack the United States?
Khorasan was working and may still be working on an effort to attack the United States or our allies and looking to do it very, very soon. I can't sit here and tell you whether it's their plan is tomorrow or 3 weeks or 3 months from now. Given our visibility, we know they're serious people bent on destruction. And so we have to act as if it's coming tomorrow.
How would you describe the terrorist networks in Syria as they exist now?
They're a product of what I describe as the metastasis of al-Qaeda. And so you have two in particular in that area, a group called al-Nusra and then ISIL. They are both vicious, sort of the inheritors of a lot of the mantle of al-Qaeda, and present different threats in a lot of ways.
Competent?
Highly.
What do you mean?
Let's stay with the Nusra group first. They are experienced terrorists, experienced bomb makers, experienced killers, experienced planners with an international eye. These are people who have thought about bringing terrorism on a global scale. ISIL is as sophisticated, maybe more, than any of the others in its media presence and its recruiting and training efforts online.
Those terrorist training efforts online appeared to play out the day before our interview in Oklahoma. Police say a man who tried to convert fellow employees to Islam beheaded a woman in his workplace. He was allegedly upset about being suspended, but the FBI is investigating whether the murder was an imitation of ISIL's beheadings.
Some people call individuals who are radicalized lone wolves. Is that the biggest threat we face?
Yeah, people use that term. It's not one I like because it conveys a sense of dignity I don't think they deserve. These homegrown violent extremists are troubled souls who are seeking meaning in some misguided way, and so they come across the propaganda, and they become radicalized on their own, sort of independent study, and they're also able to equip themselves with training, again, through the internet, and then engage in jihad after emerging from their basement.
The name lone wolf offends you?
It does. I'd prefer lone rat. To capture the kind of person we're talking about.
Lone rat.
Yeah.
Is this as dangerous a time as al-Qaeda at its peak?
No, I don't think so.
What's different?
We are better organized as an intelligence community. We're better organized and equipped at the border. We have relationships with our foreign partners, all of which make us better able to see dots and connect dots. The transformation since before 9/11 is striking.
One of the striking transformations is in the FBI's elite hostage rescue team, which has more than doubled in size since 9/11. You almost never see the HRT, but we were given rare access to their training center. These are FBI special agents practicing an assault on a building where a hostage might be held. Even in training, the team uses live ammunition and live explosives. The hostage rescue team has joined U.S. Special Operations Forces for hundreds of missions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Last June, the team swooped into Libya and grabbed a suspect indicted for a role in 2012's Benghazi attack, which killed the U.S. ambassador and three others. The new emphasis these days is to bring terrorists to court.
We're there to make sure that we have a criminal option in our country's toolbox when we take the fight to terrorists.
So they would be involved in such things as evidence collection and making sure that arrests were done in such a way that they'd be seen as admissible in court?
Yeah. Or if we grab somebody and they say something that we might want to use later, we can use special agents of the FBI to testify about it.
The hostage rescue team is symbolic of the FBI's growth since 9/11. The budget has jumped from under $4 billion a year to more than $8 billion. Comey now leads 34,000 employees.
This is called Watch.
In his operations center, we got a sense of one of the imposing things about Comey. He is 6'8". He grew up near New York City in the suburbs, where his grandfather was a police chief, and where he came face-to-face with crime at an early age.
I was a high school senior and home alone one night with my younger brother, and a gunman kicked in our front door at our home in New Jersey and held the two of us captive. We escaped. He caught us again. We escaped again. So a pretty horrific experience.
Horrific how?
Well, frightening, especially to anybody, but especially to a younger person to be threatened with a gun and to believe you're going to be killed by this guy.
You believed you were going to be killed?
I did.
What happened to that guy?
He got away. My recollection is he was part of a pattern of rapes and robberies, home invasion, rapes and robberies in that area of northern New Jersey.
Does that inform your work today in any way?
It does, but probably in a way that would surprise people. I think it most affects me in giving me a sense of what victims feel, and that even the notion no one was physically harmed doesn't mean no one was harmed, because I thought about that guy every night for 5 years. So I think it's made me a better prosecutor and investigator for being able to feel better what victims of crime experience.
He's been a federal prosecutor most of his career. In 2003, President Bush appointed him Deputy Attorney General, number two at the Justice Department. But after 2 years, he left for private industry, telling his wife that it was her turn to do what she wanted. Then the phone rang last year.
The Attorney General called and asked me if I was willing to be interviewed for FBI director. And the truth is, I told him I didn't think so, that I thought it was too much for my family, but that I would sleep on it and call him back in the morning. And so I went to bed that night convinced I was going to call him back and say no.
What happened?
I woke up and my amazing wife was gone, and I found her down in the kitchen on the computer looking at homes in the D.C. area, which was a clue. And she said, I've known you since you were 19. This is who you are. This is what you love. You've got to say yes. And then she paused and said, but they're not going to pick you anyway. So just go down there and do your best, and then we'll have no regrets.
At least you would have tried.
Right.
So you met the president.
I did.
What happened?
Had to give my wife some bad news. That her confidence in them not picking me was misplaced.
That pick gives Comey a 10-year term. He intends it to be a decade that transforms the FBI again to fight crime and espionage online.
Cybercrime is becoming everything in crime. Again, because people have connected their entire lives to the internet, that's where those who want to steal money or hurt kids or defraud go. And so it's an epidemic for reasons that make sense.
How many attacks are there on American computer systems and on people's credit card numbers and the whole mass of it? What does a day look like if you're concerned with crime in cyberspace?
Probably too many to count. I mean, I think of it as kind of an evil layer cake. At the top, you have nation-state actors who are trying to break into our systems, terrorists, organized cyber syndicates, very sophisticated, harvesting people's personal computers, down to hacktivists, down to criminals and pedophiles.
What countries are attacking the United States as we sit here in cyberspace?
Well, I don't want to give you a complete list, but I can tell you at the top of the list is the Chinese, as we have demonstrated with the charges we brought earlier this year against five members of the People's Liberation Army. They are extremely aggressive and widespread in their efforts to break into American systems to steal information that would benefit their industry.
What are they trying to get?
Information that's useful to them so they don't have to invent. They can copy or steal, so they can learn about how a company might approach a negotiation with a Chinese company, all manner of things.
How many hits from China do we take in a day?
Many, many, many. I mean, there are two kinds of big companies in the United States. There are those who've been hacked by the Chinese and those who don't know they've been hacked by the Chinese.
The Chinese are that good?
Actually, not that good. I liken them a bit to a drunk burglar. They're kicking in the front door, knocking over the vase while they're walking out with your television set. They're just prolific. Their strategy seems to be, we'll just be everywhere all the time, and there's no way they can stop us.
How much does that cost the U.S. economy every year?
Impossible to count. Billions.
Sounds like cybercrime is a long way from Bonnie and Clyde for the FBI.
Bonnie and Clyde could not do 1,000 robberies in the same day in all 50 states from their pajamas halfway around the world.
The FBI's had legendary problems upgrading its computer systems. Are you now to a place where you're satisfied that you're meeting the cybersecurity threat?
We've made great progress coordinating better as a government. When I last left government, my sense of us was kind of like four-year-old soccer. So like a clump of four-year-olds chasing the ball, we were chasing it in a pack. We're about high school soccer now. We've spread out. We pass well. But the bad guys are moving at World Cup speed, so we have to get better.
Do people understand, in your estimation, the dangers posed by cybercrime and cyber espionage?
I don't think so. I think there's something about sitting in front of your own computer, working on your own banking or your own healthcare, your own social life, that makes it hard to understand the danger. I mean, the internet is the most dangerous parking lot imaginable. But if you were crossing a mall parking lot late at night, your entire sense of danger would be heightened. You would stand straight. You'd walk quickly. You'd know where you were going. You would look for light. Well, folks are wandering around that proverbial parking lot on the internet all day long without giving it a thought to whose attachments they're opening, what sites they're visiting, and that makes it easy for the bad guys.
So tell folks at home what they need to know.
When someone sends you an email, they are knocking on your door, and when you open the attachment without looking through the peephole to see who it is, you've just opened the door and let a stranger into your life where everything you care about is.
And what might that attachment do?
Oh, take over the computer, lock the computer, and then demand a ransom payment before it would unlock, steal images from your system of your children or your, steal your banking information, take your entire life.
We have talked about a lot of menacing things in this interview. Do you think Americans should sleep well?
I think they should. I mean, the money they have invested in this government since 9/11 has been well spent. And we are better organized, better systems, better equipment, smarter deployment. We are better in every way that you'd want us to be since 9/11. We're not perfect. And my philosophy as a leader is we are never good enough, but we are in a much better place than we were 13 years ago.
Our conversation with FBI Director James Comey continues here next week, when we ask whether the FBI is snooping on average Americans and why he thinks Apple's new iPhone software could be a threat to national security.
60 Minutes, coming up after this short break.
Cloud may be just another overused buzzword, but the cloud is an effective computing environment that can save your business time and money. Barracuda Networks is no stranger to the cloud. In fact, all of our security and storage solutions connect to the cloud for continuous updates and off-site redundancy. Barracuda's cloud also plays host to our email security, web security, file sharing, and e-signing services. We even offer solutions on Amazon's AWS and Microsoft's Azure public cloud platforms. To try any of our cloud-connected solutions free, visit barracuda.com/cloud.
Guys, if you're into fantasy football, you've got to check out FanDuel.com. At FanDuel, you play in one-week fantasy football leagues for real money with immediate cash payouts. You only play when you want, and you can change your team any week. FanDuel's paying out over $10 million every week this season. And right now, FanDuel is giving you up to $200 free. That's right. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match it up to $200. Just go to FanDuel.com, click the microphone in the upper right corner, and enter code FOOTBALL70. FANDUEL.com. Code FOOTBALL, the number 70.
Cancer is so pervasive that it touches virtually every family in this country. More than one out of three Americans will be diagnosed with some form of it in their lifetime. And as anyone who's been through it knows, the shock and anxiety of the diagnosis is followed by a second jolt, the high price of cancer drugs. They are so astronomical that a growing number of patients can't afford their copay, the percentage of their drug bill they have to pay out of pocket. This has led to a revolt against the drug companies, led by some of the most prominent cancer doctors in the country.
We're in a situation where a cancer diagnosis is one of the leading causes of personal bankruptcy.
Dr. Leonard Sahls is chief of gastrointestinal oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering, one of the nation's premier cancer centers, and he's a leading expert on colon cancer.
So are you saying, in effect, that we have to start treating the cost of these drugs almost like a side effect from cancer?
I think that's a fair way of looking at it. We're starting to see the term financial toxicity being used in the literature. Individual patients are going into bankruptcy trying to deal with these prices.
The general price for a new drug is what?
They're priced at well over $100,000 a year. And remember that many of these drugs, most of them, don't replace everything else. They get added to it.
Right.
And if you figure one drug costs $120,000 and the next drug's not going to cost less, you're at $250,000 in drug costs just to get started.
I mean, you're dealing with people who are desperate.
I do worry that people's fear and anxiety is being taken advantage of. And yes, it costs money to develop these drugs, but I do think the price is too high.
The drug companies say it costs over $1 billion to bring a new drug to market, so the prices reflect the cost of innovation. The companies do provide financial assistance to some patients, but most people aren't eligible. So many in the middle class struggle to meet the cost of their co-payments. Sometimes they take half doses of the drug to save money or delay getting their prescriptions refilled. Dr. Salsa's battle against the cost of cancer drugs started in 2012 when the FDA approved Zaltrap for treating advanced colon cancer. Salsa compared the clinical trial results of Zaltrap to those of another drug already on the market, Avastin. He says both target the same patient population, work essentially in the same way, and when given as part of chemotherapy, deliver the identical result, extending median survival by 1.4 months, or 42 days.
They look to be about the same. To me, it looked like a Coke and Pepsi sort of thing.
Then Salz, as head of the hospital's pharmacy committee, discovered how much it would cost, roughly $11,000 per month, more than twice that of Avastin.
So $5,000 versus $11,000. That's quite a jump. Did it have fewer side effects? Was it less toxic? Did it have something that would explain the double price?
If anything, it looked like there might be a little more toxicity in the Zaltrap study.
He contacted Dr. Peter Bach, Sloan Kettering's in-house expert on cancer drug prices.
So, Zaltrap, one day your phone rings and it's Dr. Salz. Do you remember what he said?
He said, "Peter, I think we're not going to include a new cancer drug because it costs too much."
Had you ever heard a line like that before?
No, my response was, "I'll be right down."
You ran
and
down?
I think I took the elevator, but yes, exactly.
Bach determined that since patients would have to take Zaltrap for several months, the price tag for 42 days of extra life would run to nearly $60,000. What they then decided to do was unprecedented, reject a drug just because of its price.
We did it for one reason, because we need to take into account the financial consequences of the decisions that we make for our patients. Patients in Medicare would pay more than $2,000 a month themselves out of pocket for Zaltrap, and that was the same as the typical income every month for a patient in Medicare.
Copay.
Right. 20%. Taking money from their children's inheritance, from the money they've saved. We couldn't in good conscience say, we're going to prescribe this more expensive drug.
And then they trumpeted their decision in the New York Times, blasting what they called runaway cancer drug prices. It was a shot across the bow of the pharmaceutical industry and Congress for passing laws that Bach says allow the drug companies to charge whatever they want for cancer medications.
Medicare has to pay exactly what the drug company charges, whatever that number is.
Wait a minute. This is a law?
Yes.
And there's no negotiating whatsoever?
No.
With Medicare?
No.
Another reason drug prices are so expensive is that, according to an independent study, the single biggest source of income for private practice oncologists is the commission they make from cancer drugs. They're the ones who buy them wholesale from the pharmaceutical companies and sell them retail to their patients. The markup for Medicare patients is guaranteed by law. The average, in the case of Zaltrap, was 6%.
What that does is create a very substantial incentive to use a more expensive drug. Because if you're getting 6% of $10, that's nothing. If you're getting 6% of $10,000, that starts to add up. So now you have a real conflict of interest.
But it all starts with the drug companies setting the price.
We have a pricing system for drugs which is completely dictated by the people who are making the drugs.
How do you think they're deciding the price?
It's corporate chutzpah.
Just raise the price, period.
Just a question of how brave they are and how little they want to end up in the New York Times or on 60 Minutes.
That's because media exposure, he says, works. Right after their editorial was published, the drugs manufacturer, Sanofi, cut the price of Zaltrap by more than half.
It was a shocking event because it was irrefutable evidence that the price was a fiction. All of those arguments that we've heard for decades, we have to charge the price we charge, we have to recoup our money, we're good for society, we trust us, we'll set the right price. One op-ed in the New York Times from one hospital, and they said, oh, okay, we'll charge a different price. It was like we were in a Turkish bazaar. And they said, this carpet is $500. And you say, I'll give you $100. And the guy says, okay. They set it up to make it highly profitable for doctors to go for Zaltrap instead of Avastin. It was crazy.
But he says it got even crazier when Sanofi explained the way they were changing the price.
They lowered it in a way that doctors could get the drug for less, but patients were still paying as if it was high priced.
Oh, come on.
They said to the doctor, buy Zaltrap from us for $11,000, and we'll send you a check for $6,000. Then you give it to your patient, and you get to bill the patient's insurance company as if it cost $11,000. So it made it extremely profitable for the doctors. They could basically double their money if they use Zaltrap.
Oh, my God.
All this is accepted industry practice. After about 6 months, once Medicare and private insurers became aware of the doctor's discount, the price was cut in half for everyone.
The drug companies have to put a price on a medicine that reflects the cost of developing it, which is very expensive and takes a long period of time, and the value that it can provide.
John Castellani is president and CEO of Pharma, the drug industry's trade and lobbying group in Washington.
If you are taking a drug that's no better than another drug already on the market and charging twice as much, and everybody thought the original drug was too much.
We don't set the prices. What a patient pays is determined by his or her insurance.
Are you saying that the pharmaceutical company is not to blame for how much the patient is paying? You're saying it's the insurance company?
I'm saying the insurance model makes the medicine artificially expensive for the patient.
He's talking about the high copay for cancer drugs. If you're on Medicare, you pay 20%.
20% of $11,000 a month.
Why should
it be a lot more than 20% of $5,000 a month?
Why should it be 20% instead of
11,000 a month?
Because the cost of developing these therapies is so expensive.
Then why did Sanofi cut it in half?
I can't respond to a specific company.
Sanofi declined our request for an interview, but said in this email that they lowered the price of Zaltrap after listening to early feedback from the oncology community and to ensure affordable choices for patients.
High cancer drug prices are harming patients because either you come up with the money or you die.
Haygop Kantarjian shares the Department of Leukemia at MD Anderson in Houston. Inspired by the doctors at Sloan Kettering, he enlisted 119 of the world's leading leukemia specialists to co-sign this article about the high price of drugs that don't just add a few weeks of life, but actually add years, like Gleevec. It treats CML, one of the most common types of blood cancer. It used to be a death sentence. But with Gleevec, most patients survive for 10 years or more.
This is probably the best drug we ever developed in cancer.
In all cancers?
So far. And that shows the dilemma, because here you have a drug that makes people live their normal life. But in order to live normally, they are enslaved by the cost of the drug. They have to pay every year.
You have to stay on it.
Stay on it indefinitely.
Gleevec is the top-selling drug for industry giant Novartis, bringing in more than $4 billion a year in sales, $35 billion since the drug came to market. There are now several other drugs like it.
So you'd think that with the competition, the price of Gleevec would have come down.
And yet the price of the drug tripled from $28,000 a year in 2001 to $92,000 a year in 2012.
Are you saying that the drug companies are raising the prices on their older drugs, just the new ones? So you have a new drug that might come out at $100,000, but they're also saying the old drugs have to come up to that price too?
Exactly. They are making prices unreasonable, unsustainable, and, in my opinion, immoral.
When we asked Novartis why they tripled the price of Gleevec, they told us Gleevec has been a life-changing medicine. When setting the prices of our medicines, we consider the benefits they bring to patients, the price of existing treatments, and the investments needed to continue to innovate.
This is quite an expensive medication.
Dr. Kentarjian says one thing that has to change is the law that prevents Medicare from negotiating for lower prices.
This is unique to the United States. If you look anywhere in the world, there are negotiations, either by the government or by different regulatory bodies who regulate the price of the drug. And this is why the prices are 50 to 80% lower anywhere in the world compared to the United States.
50 to 80%?
50 to 80%.
The same drug?
Same drug. American patients end up paying 2 to 3 times more for the same drug compared to Canadians or Europeans or Australians and others.
Now, Novartis, which makes Gleevec, says that the price is fair because this is a miracle drug. It really works.
The only drug that works is a drug that a patient can afford.
The challenge, Dr. Saltz at Sloan Kettering says, is knowing where to draw the line between how long a drug extends life and how much it costs. Where is that line?
I don't know where that line is, but we as a society have been unwilling to discuss this topic. And as a result, the only people that are setting the line are the people that are selling the drugs.
60 Minutes, coming up after this short break.
I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.
Human beings have lived with dogs for thousands of years. You'd think that after all that time, we'd have discovered all there is to know about them. But it turns out that until recently, scientists didn't pay much attention to dogs. Dolphins have been studied for decades, apes and chimps as well. But dogs, with whom we share our lives, were never thought to be worthy of serious study. As a result, we know very little about what actually goes on inside dogs' brains. Do they really love us, or are dogs just licking us so they can get fed? How much of our language can they understand? Before you answer, we want you to meet Chaser, who's been called the smartest dog in the world.
Yeah, we're going to Wofford. Hoop! Good girl, good girl, good girl.
86-year-old retired psychology professor John Pilley and his border collie Chaser are inseparable.
We're almost there. We're almost there. Can you speak? Speak. Speak. Good girl, good girl.
Do you view Chaser as a family pet, as a friend? How do you see Chaser?
She's our child.
She's
our child, a member of the family. Oh, yes. She comes first.
Many people think of their dogs as children, but John Pilley has been teaching her like a child as well. By assigning names to toys,
okay, Chase.
Pilley has been helping Chaser learn words and simple sentences.
Take KG.
He's been teaching her up to 5 hours a day.
Yes.
5 days a week for the past 9 years.
My best metaphor is this is a two-year-old toddler.
That's how you think about your dog, a two-year-old toddler.
Yeah. She has the capabilities of a two-year-old. Chicken, chicken, chicken. Where's chicken?
He's not kidding.
Yes, good girl.
Most two-year-old toddlers
in tub
know about 300 words.
Figure eight, figure eight. Good girl, that's figure eight.
Chaser's vocabulary
good girl.
Is three times that.
To tub.
She's learned the names of more than 1,000 toys. And all of those toys add up.
Wheel, yes, bring it out.
To show us Chaser's collection, Pilly brought us to his back porch.
So these are all the toys in here?
Yes.
Got a chicken in here. Okay. Is it all right if I dump them out?
Please do, please do.
Okay.
There are 800 cloth animals, 116 different balls, and more than 100 plastic toys. 1,022 toys in all, each with a unique name.
So Chaser could recognize the names of every one of these toys.
That's true. That's true.
To prove it, Pilly cataloged the toys and then, over the course of 3 years, gave Chaser hundreds of tests like this.
Chaser, find circle. Find circle.
In every test, Chaser correctly identified 95% or more of the toys.
Find circle, Chase. Yeah.
The results were published in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, and a star was born.
How are you?
Good to see you.
I'm so glad to see you.
Chaser even landed a book deal.
You too.
But John Pilly didn't stop with the names of toys.
Nose KG. Nose KG. Nose it. Nose it. Good girl.
He's taught Chaser that nouns and verbs have different meanings.
Point, point, point.
And can be combined in a variety of ways.
Take wheel. Do it, go. Do it. Okay. Out, out. Chase. Take KG. Do it. Good, good girl. Good girl.
So she's actually understanding the difference between take, paw, putting her paw on something, and putting her nose on something.
Right. And that's what we're demonstrating.
All this learning has been possible, Pilly says, because of a breakthrough Chaser had when she was just a puppy.
At a certain point, she realized that objects have names.
Right. It was an insight. It came to her.
How could you tell that she'd suddenly had that insight?
Well, it was in the fifth month, and she'd learned about 40 names, and the time necessary to work with her kept getting shorter and shorter.
She was starting to learn words faster and faster?
Yes.
It's the closest thing in animals we've seen to being like what young children do as they're learning words.
Brian Hare, an evolutionary anthropologist at Duke University, believes Chaser is the most important dog in the history of modern scientific research.
This is very serious science. We're not talking about stupid pet tricks where people have spent, you know, hours trying to just, you know, train a dog to do the same thing over and over. What's neat about what Chaser's doing is Chaser is learning tons, literally thousands of new things by using the same ability that kids use when they learn lots of words.
He's talking about what researchers call social inference, a capability humans, like Hare's son Luke, acquire around age one. To demonstrate the concept, Hare hides a ball under one of these two cups.
Hey, looky guy, where is it? Can you get it? Can you get the ball?
Luke doesn't know which cup the ball is under.
Can you get it?
But when his father points, he makes an inference.
Hey, nice job.
You got it.
So what does that show you?
So when kids his age start understanding pointing, it's right when the foundations of what lead to language and culture start to develop.
Hey.
It might look simple, but when Hare tried the same test with bonobos, great apes he studied for more than a decade, look what happened. Bonobos, our closest genetic relatives, can't do it.
You chose the wrong one.
But Hare discovered dogs can.
You ready? All right, I'm going to hide in one of these two places.
This two-year-old Labrador named Sisu has no trouble understanding the meaning of pointing.
Now, she doesn't know for sure which place you put
it. That's right. There's no way she could know, and I'm just going to tell her where it is. Okay, Sisu. So that's really hard for a lot of animals, and that's what's really special about dogs is they're really similar to even human toddlers.
That's a level of thinking that people didn't really think dogs could do.
Right. I mean, there was no evidence until the last decade that dogs were capable of inferential reasoning. Absolutely not. So that's what's new. That's what's shocking is that of all the species, it's dogs that are showing a couple of abilities that are really important that allow humans to develop culture and language.
It's not surprising that dogs share characteristics with humans. After all, we've evolved alongside each other for more than 15,000 years. There are now some 80 million dogs in this country. More dogs than children. But for all the playing and petting, the companionship, we still know very little about their brains. Dr. Greg Burns, a physician and neuroscientist at Emory University, has studied the human brain for more than two decades. But 3 years ago, questions he had about his own dog inspired him to start looking at the canine brain.
It started out with the desire to know, really, what does my dog think of me? I love my dog, but do they reciprocate in any way? When they hear you come home, you know, they start jumping around. Is it just because they expect you to feed them? Is this just a scam by the dogs?
Are dogs just big scammers?
Yeah.
To try and answer that question, Dr. Burns is doing something scientists have had a difficult time with. He's conducting brain scans on dogs while they're awake and unsedated. Inside the fMRI machine, they're trained to stay completely still.
How hard is it to get a dog to do this?
This represents probably about 3 to 4 months of training. Uh-huh. And so most of the dogs take that long.
What's around Tigger's head here?
The scanner makes a lot of noise. It's quite loud. And because dogs' hearing is more sensitive than ours, we have to protect their hearing just like ours. So we put earplugs and earmuffs and just wrap it all to just keep it in place.
Okay, now you go up.
Tigger certainly knows the drill.
That's good.
Once in the machine, he lies down and doesn't move. These scans are giving Dr. Burns the first glimpse at how a dog's brain actually works.
So these are slices of Tigger's brain that you're seeing?
Yeah, exactly. So we're slicing from top to bottom. We analyze them later to see which parts increase in response to the different signals. Mm.
While in the scanner, the dogs smell cotton swabs with different scents. First, the underarm sweat of a complete stranger. Next, the sweat of their owner. As Dr. Burns expected, when the dogs sniff the swabs, the part of their brain associated with smell, an area right behind the nose, activated. It didn't matter what the scent was. But it was when the dogs got a whiff of their owner's sweat that another area of the brain was stimulated, the caudate nucleus, or reward center. Dr. Burns believes that means the dog is experiencing more than the good feeling that comes with a meal. It shows the dog is recognizing somebody extremely important to them. It's the same area in a human brain that activates when we listen to a favorite song or anticipate being with someone we love.
So just by smelling the sweat of their owner, it triggers something in a much stronger way than it does with a stranger.
Right, which means that it's a positive feeling, a positive association.
And that's something you can prove through MRIs. It's not just, I mean, previously people would say, well, yeah, obviously my dog loves me. I see its tail wagging and it seems really happy when it sees me.
Right. Now we're using the brain as kind of the test to say, okay, when we see activity in these reward centers, that means the dog is experiencing something that it likes or it wants, and it's a good feeling.
My takeaway from this is that I'm not being scammed by my dog.
Did you have that
beforehand? Yeah, I worry about that all the time.
Watch YouTube videos of dogs welcoming home returning service members, and it's easy to see the bond between dogs and their owners.
I've missed you too.
Brian Hare says there's even more proof of that bond. It's found in our bloodstreams.
We know that when dogs and humans make eye contact, that actually releases what's known as the love hormone, oxytocin, in both the dog and the human.
It turns out oxytocin, the same hormone that helps new mothers bond with their babies, is released in both dogs and humans when they play, touch, or look into one another's eyes.
Thank you very much.
What we know now is that when dogs are actually looking at you, they're essentially hugging you with their eyes.
Really?
Yes. And so it's not just that when a dog is making a lot of eye contact with you that they're just trying to get something from you. It actually probably is just really enjoyable for them because they get an oxytocin or they get an uptick in this love hormone too.
All these new discoveries about dogs have led Brian Hare to create a science-based website called Dognition, where owners can learn to play games to test their dog's brain power.
So you're allowing people to do an intelligence test for their dog.
That's exactly right. And the idea, though, is that there's not one type of intelligence. We help you measure things like how your dog communicates, how empathic your dog is. Is your dog cunning? Is your dog actually capable of abstract thought, like reasoning?
So there are different kinds of intelligence for dogs, just like with humans.
Absolutely. And so just like some humans are good at English and others are good at math, it's the same for dogs.
When Hare tested his own dog, a mixed breed named Tassie, he was surprised by what he learned.
What I found out was that I had somebody sleeping in my bed that I didn't even know.
Really?
And I didn't know my dog doesn't really rely on its working memory. So if I'm saying sit and stay, I no longer have to wonder why my dog wanders off. Mm. He, like, literally forgot.
So your dog's not the the sharpest of dogs.
He did great on communication. He's very communicative.
So he could basically be a TV anchor, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Fetch shirt. Fetch shirt. There we go.
If you're wondering how Chaser did on Brian Hare's intelligence tests, she was off the charts on reasoning and memory. Not surprising, perhaps, considering Chaser is a border collie. Dogs bred specifically for their ability to understand how farmers want their sheep herded.
Is Chaser just like an Einstein of dogs?
So that's really fun. Is Chaser somehow special? And I think the idea actually is that no. I mean, when Dr. Pilly chose Chaser, he just randomly took her out of a litter.
Drop, drop.
What's special is that he spent so much time playing these games to help her learn words.
Three.
But are there lots of Chasers out there? Absolutely.
On your mark, get set, go.
There's going to be a lot of people who see this and are jealous of your relationship with Chaser. I mean, I now think about my own dog and kind of think, wow, I've missed the boat. I haven't sort of helped my dog live up to her potential.
Well, start working with your dog more.
Yeah, you're so sweet.
In the mail this week, viewers wrote about Steve Croft's interview with President Obama, and it was as if we had broadcast two different conversations. Some writers accused us of being rude, even bullying the president. I have never seen such a lack of respect for the president. Other viewers watched the same interview and came away with an entirely different impression. Nothing but softball questions. I'm Scott Pelley. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes. Tomorrow, be sure to watch CBS This Morning, and I'll see you on the CBS Evening News.